Hello, and welcome to Life's Little Mysteries with Live Science. I'm Gina Briner, Editor-in-Chief at Live Science.
And I'm Mindy Weisberger, a Senior Writer at Live Science.
Today, we're bringing you a special episode of Life's Little Mysteries. Usually, we keep things pretty light, but this time, we're going to focus on a serious topic that everybody is talking about, and that's the SARS coronavirus 2, the virus that causes the disease COVID-19.
At Life Science, our reporters and our editors are tracking the latest coronavirus developments around the world, from global case numbers and quarantines to vaccine development to best practices for safety, prevention, and treatment.
Here with the latest coronavirus news is Life Science health reporter Nicoletta Lanis. She's at the forefront of our coronavirus coverage.
This episode was recorded on July 30th and features Nicoletta's weekly coronavirus video update and Q&A. New updates are live streamed on Facebook every Thursday at 12 p.m. ET.
Hello, and welcome to this week's coronavirus update from Live Science. My name is Nicoletta Lanis, and I am a reporter at the site, and I am here to answer your questions about COVID-19 and give you a brief update on news from the week. If you want to hear or if you want to get a preview of what I'll be talking about this week, we have listed it in the caption of this video, so you can check that out before I begin. Just to give you a heads up, this is our 26th live stream to date. So thank you for sticking around if you've been with us from the beginning. And for those of you who are just tuning in for the first time, welcome. How this works is I'll give a brief update, and then partway through I will transition into answering whatever questions you have in the comments, and I will try to get to as many as I can in the allotted time. Just to give you a quick update on the case counts, both worldwide and here in the U.S. Worldwide, we're seeing that more than 17 million cases have now been reported, and more than 667,000 deaths worldwide. These are based on the Johns Hopkins virus dashboard metrics and may differ slightly from other databases that are collecting this. Here in the US, we now see the tally up to 4.4 million cases, exceeding that. And the death count is now above 150,000 here in the US. Moving into our first update, there is a new competition that's just been launched by a nonprofit called XPRIZE, which is offering a cash prize to whatever group can come up with the cheapest and fastest coronavirus diagnostic exam. So at this stage in the pandemic, we're still seeing massive delays in turnaround times for tests, but also just access to tests is not ubiquitous across the US or across the world. So in some places, you're seeing both these testing result delays, but difficulty even getting to the test in the first place, limits on the chemical reagents required to run the tests, all these sorts of things. So given these limitations and the fact that this, in effect, hobbles our response to the virus because it becomes more difficult to identify new cases, this competition is aimed at developing better and faster coronavirus diagnostic tests. So XPRIZE, again, is a nonprofit organization which runs public competitions of this kind to encourage technological innovation that benefits humanity in some way. So they've geared their efforts towards coronavirus testing at this moment, and the competition will be ongoing for the next 6 months. The deadline to enter, if you are someone who would like to enter, is August 31st. So you have about a month to sign up for that. And their qualifications for the test is that they should have a turnaround time of no more than 12 hours, although some tests that are being designed could turn around results within about 15 minutes. So these are more rapid fire kind of tests. So 12 hours would be the long end of that spectrum. Really, we're aiming to turn around tests in less than an hour, which would be ideal. And they are saying that an individual test should cost no more than $15 each. So at the moment, an individual test can cost about $100. So it would be much more affordable and more accessible if they were cheaper to receive. And again, free testing is available in some places. You just have to check ahead of time to see what is available in your specific area. And that $100 might be deferred to either insurance or to the hospital itself again, depending on whether that's a free service in your area or whether you'd be expected to cover those costs yourself in some way. The winning teams for this competition should be able to conduct a minimum of 500 tests in a week for over the course of 60 days. So to keep up that volume and not experience delays would be the goal. And then have the potential to scale up from that 500 test minimum to a scale of thousands of tests being conducted per week, and keeping that up at scale would be the goal. The winners of the competition, there's several categories that you can enter into. Overall, they're offering prizes of up to $5 million, but that will be divvied up among these different categories. The categories include at-home tests that a person could give themselves and then send in the samples, or perhaps even get the results right away there at their home. Point of care, which is where you are as close to the patient that's in hospital or in clinic as possible. So you might just go to another room, conduct the process the diagnostic test there, and then come immediately back to the patient. It would be point of care. Distributed lab and high throughput labs are ones where you would send off the sample to a laboratory setting of some sort, whether that be a laboratory that's on site at a hospital or one that's processing thousands and thousands of tests in a more high volume commercial kind of setup. We will keep an eye on that for the upcoming 6 months. Of course, the winners will not be announced for some time, but in the meantime, there may be incremental advances, perhaps in diagnostic testing, that we can keep you updated on that front. Moving on to a bit of a strange news story that we covered this week. The original news report about this came from MIT Technology Review, so I just wanted to plug that original report. It was an investigative piece. So that report revealed that there is a small group of scientists based in Boston that have developed their own DIY coronavirus vaccine. This is a group of about 20 plus scientists, technologists, as well as science enthusiasts is how they've been described, who got together in an effort to develop a vaccine that they could access before the official vaccine that will become more widely available and mass produced for the public comes out, was kind of their goal. This effort has been spearheaded by geneticist Preston Istep, who is a protege of geneticist George Church. If you've heard of him, he's a Harvard-based geneticist who is in the news fairly frequently. But in any case, they designed this vaccine, and because it's not being developed in the context of a formal clinical trial, and they produce it, anyone who takes this vaccine essentially gets the ingredients and has to concoct the vaccine themselves by mixing it up. And then it is a nasal spray administration. So you spray that formula up your nose. And because this is essentially a route of self-medication, self-experimentation using mail order ingredients, the FDA doesn't have oversight over projects like this necessarily. Now, if this grows to some size, especially now that the recipe is online and easily accessible, the FDA may have some jurisdiction to step in. That is unclear at this time, and we will follow up on that huge question at a later date. To give you some idea of what's going on with this vaccine, it's a subunit vaccine is what it's known as, which means it contains these very short, they're not full-size proteins, but they are essentially share the same structure as a protein, but are too small to be considered a full protein. So these are called peptides, and these peptides are found on the virus itself. So they are not assembled in a way that could infect a person, but they, in theory, should alert the immune system once inside the body. And then the immune system builds up antibodies and memory T cells and other such immune responses in order to deal with those peptides. And then if a person would ever encounter the real virus, they would recognize those peptides on its surface and go after it. This is the theory. There are existing peptide-based vaccines or subunit vaccines, as I've said. There are not an incredibly large number, but there are good examples of ones that work. So that was the idea that forms the basis of this vaccine. The vaccine beyond peptides also includes a substance found in the shells of crustaceans like shrimp. So this substance was added to coat these peptides and help them to more easily enter the tissues of the nose, which are known as mucosal tissues. These are semi-permeable tissues that line both your eye sockets, for instance, and your nose, nasal cavity, all these surfaces that are often exposed to debris from the outside environment and also pathogens, other incoming, basically anything from the environment that we initially breathe in or come into contact with can come into contact with these mucosal surfaces. Because of their vulnerability to these pathogens, etc., not only are they often armed with mucosal cells that secrete mucus and capture those debris and pathogens in that sticky fluid, in addition, mucosal tissues have their own specialized fleet of immune cells that serve them specifically. So ideally, any coronavirus vaccine would activate the local immune system. Think of it as, you know, you have a more localized, robust response, and then you have your systemic whole body response. So a vaccine hopefully would engage both of those forces to get rid of the coronavirus. And there are scientists who believe that because of that need for mucosal-based immunity, that a nose spray, a nasal delivery of a vaccine may be the best route for whatever vaccine gets approved. So again, this was the underlying idea behind the vaccine these 20-plus scientists came up with. What differentiates this vaccine from ones that are in formal trials is that there's been no regulatory oversight into how it was developed, into whether it garners any immune response, let alone the immune response you want at the level you want, but also whether it is safe to administer, and especially over long periods of time. So vaccines and formal studies go through both preclinical work in animal models and labs, so just in cells that are in petri dishes, before they ever get into humans. Then they're tested in humans for initially safety mostly. So you're looking for any side effects that can arise when the vaccine is given. These on the short term might include immune-based responses. So there might be swelling or redness or soreness at the site of an either injection or in the nasal cavity if it's a nasal spray-based vaccine. In addition, you might experience fever for a few days or something to that effect. So we're looking for those types of thing in phase one. In phase two, we start looking at the immune responses that the body has to the vaccine. Does it develop antibodies? Are there signs that memory T cells are coming online? At this point, this group of scientists have not completed any of those studies, but they are already distributing materials to make the vaccine to members of their social circles. So an estimated 70 or so individuals have received materials for the vaccine. It is unknown exactly how many actually have mixed it together and taken it at this point. So there's not good oversight of even who has received and taken the vaccine because they are not following up with those subjects in a codified way. They are conducting studies to look into the safety and efficacy now, after the fact, after many people have already received it. And again, there's a white paper online detailing exactly what's in the vaccine and how to mix it up and how to formulate it. And at the top, there's a long, long list of disclaimers pushing any responsibility for said vaccine onto the person who makes it and the person who takes it. So that's legalese to cover the scientists who came up with the vaccine. All this to just say that this should be taken as a cautionary tale as to there's a reason that vaccines, especially for wide deployment, go through so many phases of clinical trials. Because number one, you want them to work at baseline. And at this point, there's zero proof that this vaccine works. So how confident are you that it's actually protective against the coronavirus? At this point, there's no data either way. Number two, you want it to be safe. And given that this is a coronavirus vaccine, there is some concern that exposure to the virus, if the vaccine garners a side effect known as antibody-dependent enhancement, which is a fairly rare phenomenon where a prior infection or a vaccination can leave the body more vulnerable to serious infection down the line. This was seen in animal studies of other coronavirus vaccine candidates, so not in relation to this current coronavirus, but others that came before it. So in clinical trials, especially phase 3 clinical trials, which include tens of thousands of people, you can watch out for, okay, when people are exposed to the virus, number one, are they protected against infection? If they're not, do you see any signs that the infection is worse than it would have been had they not received the vaccine? These sorts of follow-ups cannot be done outside of the context of a phase 3 trial, setting themselves up for risk of that especially, but also any other side effects that they may not be anticipating. So at this point, this is essentially what you can see as any home remedy, unproven home remedy for coronavirus prevention. It's just wrapped up in more scientific lingo, is kind of the take-home message from that shenanigans. Just to wrap up my update, another kind of sketchy thing that's going on in the world of coronavirus is that we are now seeing more and more hand sanitizers with dangerous levels of methanol, which is a type of alcohol that can be toxic both when applied on the skin, so it can be absorbed through skin, and if applied in high enough quantities, can poison the person applying it. But the major concern is that people might consume it in some way, especially children who put their hands in their mouths more consistently than adults do. So the FDA has now identified at least 77 hand sanitizers that contain dangerous levels of methanol. And back in June, they had only flagged 9 from a specific company, which is called Esk Biochem. But now all these others have emerged, and they have a comprehensive list on the FDA website. You can find that link in our story on Live Science on the topic. It's way up at the top of the story. And best advice I can give you is, if you're concerned that a hand sanitizer you have might be contaminated, number one, check that list. It's very easy to search through, and they're adding to it every day whenever they find new contaminated products. You can also call poison control. So whether that be your local poison control or a national service, they also have access to these lists and can see which brand of hand sanitizer you have, and they can help you sort out whether it's on that list or not. So that might be easier than searching through the list yourself in some cases. Now, a big question, of course, that we dug into a bit this week is, why would methanol be showing up in hand sanitizers at all? What's the deal with that? There's 2 possible explanations. The first might just be shoddy manufacturing processes, being that given the really high demand for hand sanitizers, many people jumped onto the market to begin producing hand sanitizers early on in the pandemic. And there was a shortage of ethanol distillate, which is the appropriate type of alcohol you want in hand sanitizer. And there's several other options to serve as the base of hand sanitizer, but that's the one that you see most often. And those distillates, which are just concentrated fluids that contain the alcohol that you want, those were hard to come by in bulk. So people may have just turned to methanol because it is very similar in smell and appearance to ethanol. And you may be able to get away with using that as your base, given that you dilute hand sanitizer with other products and you can add a scent on top of it to mask that smell, if that was a giveaway. So that's a possibility that hasn't been investigated thoroughly, exactly why the methanol is ending up in hand sanitizer. But that's a possibility, is that they're just starting out with methanol straight off. Another possibility is that methanol is a byproduct of alcohol distillation always. So this goes for both hand sanitizer products, but also alcohol that we consume, so different liquors and such. So when you are distilling a whiskey or any sort of grain-based alcohol, anything like that, the manufacturers must first, after you fermented the sugars, which begins to produce these alcohols, including both methanol and ethanol, you then put those fermented sugars into your distillation apparatus and you boil them. And methanol boils at a lower temperature than ethanol does. So as the vat is coming up to temperature, you're going to have that methanol filtering through the apparatus before the ethanol does. So what they do is, there's a certain cutoff point as it's coming up to temperature, and they call this cutting the run of the stream of alcohol. And there comes a certain point when the density of that alcohol in the collection container switches from the density of methanol to indicate that ethanol is now flowing, and they cut off that stream and they swap out the container. So they're collecting primarily ethanol. At commercial alcohol manufacturers, they go through iterative quality assurance processes to make sure that process is happening appropriately. Professionals can tell by the smell and taste of the product whether the methanol content is too high. They monitor the temperature within that distillation chamber, but also they can send off samples of their distillate for gas chromatography mass spectrometry analysis, which is just a fancy way of saying it determines the ratio of chemicals within a given batch of alcohol. So if you don't have all these quality assurance measures in place, you can end up with a product that has too much methanol in it, which is partially why home distillation, so moonshine that's made illicitly or other alcohols that you distill at home, can sometimes be more risky because you don't have those quality assurance procedures to back you up. So you end up with too much methanol in the product. And to give you an idea of how lethal this stuff can be, if you consume it, so you're drinking it in some way, for children, drinking as little as 2 tablespoons of methanol can be deadly. And for adults, between 2 to 8 ounces, so that's 60 to 240 milliliters. So it's a very low dose required to actually kill a person. The other scary thing about methanol is that it takes some time for those symptoms of poisoning to set in, because the methanol itself is not doing the poisoning. Once it reaches your liver and begins to be broken down, it's the enzymes that break down the methanol that begin to cause the problem. So methanol breaks down first into formaldehyde, which you may be familiar with from science class when you're dissecting frogs. And then that formaldehyde gets broken down into formic acid, which is highly toxic to cells, but especially nerve cells. So at a lower doses, you may only experience symptoms of nausea. You will feel intoxicated because it is an alcohol and it works similarly to ethanol. There's also, with that formic acid, the acidity of your blood rises and you react by hyperventilating because your body is trying to get rid of CO2. So these are all early signs of that poisoning setting in. If you've consumed or applied a high enough dose, though, you can begin experiencing blurry vision, and people describe it as it can advance to feeling like you're walking through a snowstorm, like you really can't see well at all. And this can progress to blindness, permanent blindness, if you do not get treated right away. So these symptoms may take 4 to 6 hours to even begin to emerge after you've consumed or applied way too much methanol. And there's various reasons as to why it targets nerve cells in particular, but in particular, it disrupts the metabolism of cells and they begin to swell because they can't maintain the appropriate ratio of chemicals and charged particles inside and outside of the cell. In addition, metabolic waste like lactate build up throughout the body, and nerve cells especially run at a very high metabolism and they require a base level of energy to maintain balance and not begin to malfunction and die. So all that to say, please check the list of hand sanitizers on the FDA website, again, also on the Live Science website. And just to quell any nervousness, applying through on your skin, especially if you're only using it on your hands, you would need to apply that product repeatedly to actually become poisoned. So if you've only applied a little bit, it's probably not a huge deal and your body's just going to deal with that. But consuming is the really big problem here, especially. And especially in the context of some hand sanitizers coming in kind of novelty bottles that a child, especially a young child, might mistake as something to drink, anything like that. And children, even if applying only to the skin, children are at slightly higher risk because they simply have a greater skin surface area to body weight ratio. So a lower dose will impact them much more dramatically than it would an adult. So just a word of caution there. And I hope you learned something about alcohol distillation as an aside. All that said, we'll move on to our Q&A. I'm getting the question as to whether there is a projected end of COVID being a worldwide problem so we can get back to some semblance of normal. In general, we're going to be a lot closer to normality when we have more effective treatments. So remdesivir has been more widely applied at this point and has seems to have some positive effect for especially hospitalized patients, but we would hope to have more treatments available for a wider group of coronavirus patients to actually stop the virus from replicating once it's inside you. So we need more treatments, number one. And I imagine we will see more earning emergency use authorization, at least within the end of this year, so 2020. We also, of course, are aiming for a vaccine, which if you combine treatments and vaccines, you can really start to get especially pandemic level outbreaks under control in a more substantial way without having to also modify your day-to-day behavior. So right now, because we don't have both a wide arsenal of treatments and we don't have a vaccine in place, we then have to modify our personal behaviors to deal with the virus, which is where all these social distancing measures come in, which is where mask wearing comes in. My personal projection, this is not an official prediction, but given the rate of vaccine development that we're seeing now, I could see a vaccine at least being approved for some group of people, maybe not everyone in the population. So maybe not every age group, especially is what I'm thinking. But I'm thinking a vaccine could potentially be ready for deployment by first quarter, second quarter 2021. This is my rough estimate as of today. Tomorrow, it might be different depending on what we hear about these vaccine trials. But following the deployment of a vaccine more widely, we can start moving towards things getting back to some normal. I do predict that there will be some sort of social distancing measures. There will be definitely surveillance for coronavirus cases ongoing, probably for the next number of years. And I'm hoping personally, and I'm predicting, that mask wearing will become more common for a long period of time, at least, especially when flu season comes around, because if you can cut down on cases of the flu, you have fewer people coming in with both coronavirus and flu, and coronavirus and flu both put enormous strain on the same entities within hospital systems, and in particular, the medical ICUs. The largest surge they see year over year is influenza season. So every year, medical ICUs prepare for flu season and bulk up their resources and increase their capacity. So it may be that with both coronavirus and influenza to deal with, we may see measures come in place around the winter months to try to cut down on the number of both overall so that our hospital systems can handle it. So long answer to your short question, I think within the next 2 years, we'll get to some semblance of pretty much normal, but there will be some significant day-to-day changes that we'll slowly get used to over time, which may include more frequent mask wearing, maybe not everywhere like we do now, but maybe in, for instance, here, I'm hoping in the subways it becomes more the norm. And we may see other measures on that front. You may have to get a booster coronavirus vaccine every couple of years or so. So that would be a new version of normal, would be integrating that response into our everyday lives. I'm getting a number of questions about schools opening, so I'm going to kind of lump them all together. I'm getting questions about how soon will we know whether these school reopenings that are planned are causing additional spikes of coronavirus. And some people are asking about whether public schools and colleges will conduct on-campus classes. For that second question, it's really a college-to-college decision. And at least the people I know who are still in college, whether at the undergrad or grad level, I know some of them do have in-person classes scheduled at this moment in time, but different programs are dealing with that in different ways. There's also many who are enrolled for next semester, but have been informed at this point that all their classes will be online. So it's still very much up in the air, depending on your specific college that you're talking about. We will know whether school reopenings are causing spikes within a number of weeks following the opening of whatever school you're focused on. So ideally, what would happen is that wherever you are, wherever you're located, there's a robust contact tracing program, which is where every time someone tests positive for COVID-19, they then reach out to every person they've had close contact with in recent days and weeks and inform them they may have been exposed to the virus and offer information to get them access to testing, to self-isolate if they are likely to have the infection, tell them about what symptoms to watch out for in case they need to seek medical care, all that sort of thing. So ideally, if you have these contact tracing programs in place, every time a child or a teacher or a staff member at a school tests positive, you would learn about that. And then the contact tracers would actually be able to reach out to the school itself to ensure that everyone on campus knows that there was at least one person who tested positive. But then for that school to take extra precautions and to follow up with thorough contact tracing within the facility itself. So in Texas, for instance, there's a few contact tracing programs at the local county level that reach out to, for example, since schools aren't yet open, whenever there's an outbreak at either a homeless shelter or a nursing home, anything where people are living in very close quarters and don't really leave the facility as much, they reach out to both individuals, but to the facility at large so they can take extra precautions. So we'll see spikes within a few weeks, but maybe sooner if contact tracing is robust in your area, is what the takeaway from that is. We're already seeing, there was a recent report that was published in the New York Times that detailed which college campuses specifically have already seen cases connected to people being on campus. So you can look that up and see where your school ranks. I have a lot of contacts in Florida, and the Florida schools are ranking high in those categories, for example, even with schools having been closed technically. So lots of questions there. The big question, of course, is how to follow up if a spike happens. And the answer, unfortunately, might be to either send most kids from the infected class home for a number of weeks or to close the whole school altogether. Again, this is a very school-to-school based decision. And hopefully there are protocols being designed so that people know what to do in the event that somebody catches coronavirus. I'm getting a question about reinfection. This has been a hot topic since the start of the pandemic. So the idea that people, number one, can test positive for the coronavirus with a standard diagnostic test, test negative, and then test positive again in short order. Also that some people have waves of symptoms for weeks after their initial infection. So the question from both of these trends that has emerged is, are these people just getting infected with the virus a second time? At this point, the data points to most likely in the majority of these people, it's just a long drawn out initial illness and it's just coming either in waves. It should be noted that even if you have a mild coronavirus infection and you're not experiencing those severe symptoms that we think about, it's possible to test positive on a standard diagnostic test up to, say, 100 days out from your first positive test. And since the tests do have a certain percentage of false positives and false negatives, there's a possibility in the middle there, if you get tested again, that you could test negative and then test positive, when really the virus is in you the whole time. So given that slight inconsistency, that pattern is not an unexpected one. In addition, the diagnostic tests that are typically used simply search for evidence of genetic material from the virus circulating in the body. So the coronavirus is based on a genetic material called RNA, which is a cousin of DNA, in essence, very similar structure. So what these diagnostic tests, PCR tests specifically, do is they amplify small samples of that genetic material. By amplify, you need to make within the contraption that use the process diagnostic tests. What it's doing is simply making copy after copy after copy after copy of whatever genetic material it can find. And once it's amplified to a high enough degree, you can spot that with your chemical reagents that you're using, and you can say, yes, the virus is definitely inside you. Now, that virus that you found might not necessarily be infecting new cells. It might be viral debris from dead virus that's still in your system. There's also a possibility that there's a certain percentage of virus that remains, the immune system may hang on to bits of the virus as it's building up long-term immunity. We see this trend with other viruses, including the measles, for instance, where you can test positive for measles, evidence of measles, for a long time. But the theory is that it may be that immune cells harbor small amounts of the virus as they're building up this long-term immune memory. So in case the whole virus comes back later on, the immune system is better equipped to deal with it because it spent that time learning what that virus looks like. So that's a possibility. That's highly theoretical immunology. But think about that when you're thinking about these persistent positive, negative, positive trends. In addition, if you wanted to make wholly sure that that was an active infection, so you spot viral genetic material, the absolute gold standard in like a laboratory setting would be to then take the sampled virus that you had and try to grow it in a lab dish, because then you could prove that, yes, we found virus, but also that virus is still actively replicating. And we do this in laboratory studies and animal studies, but in the context of diagnosing people, that takes so much time and is very involved. So typically that extra step is not done. That's far more confined to laboratory settings. So it's difficult to do that second round of checking to make sure it's an active infection. There may be a teeny tiny percentage of people on the number of, say, 0.01%. That's not an official percent, but that's the one that's been thrown out by experts, that they are harboring the virus in such a way that there's a reservoir of active virus in the body that's then re-emerging to jumpstart infection a second time. You might have heard of viral reservoirs in the context of HIV, for instance, which takes refuge in the body and transforms into a latent state. They do not think at this point, there's no evidence that the coronavirus enters a latent state and hides out in cells, but there's a possibility that it persists at very low levels in some people and then can resurge, which again would not be reinfection. That would simply be a resurgence of an earlier infection. It seems that if that is the case, it's very rare that that's happening, and it's more likely that people are simply experiencing several waves of symptoms. Again, this is simply what we know today. If there is clear evidence of reinfection down the line, we will definitely be covering that story. I do want to emphasize once more, though, that testing positive, testing negative, and then testing positive again is not clear-cut evidence of reinfection. That's not what those tests mean. So if you know that, hopefully that can quell your worries a little bit. Someone's asking about the presentation of different types of symptoms from this coronavirus. While we think of the virus as a primarily respiratory illness, meaning it affects your lungs, it affects your upper respiratory tract, which includes the nasal cavity and upper portions of your throat, and the virus definitely infects those cells directly, it also impacts both the cardiovascular system, so including your heart, but also blood vessels more widely, and inflammation, especially garnered from the infection, can also injure blood vessels and cardiovascular tissue. So we're thinking about the respiratory system, we're thinking about the cardiovascular system, and we're talking about the digestive system. Some people primarily present with digestive symptoms, which may include nausea, diarrhea, vomiting, things of this nature, because the digestive tract also hosts cells that have the ACE2 receptor, which is what the virus uses as a gateway to enter cells and infect them. So there's evidence that the virus can directly infect the digestive tract and thereby beget all these symptoms. Variants from individual to individual may also be influenced by your genetics. It's influenced by what other medical conditions you have at the same time. So there's a lot of variability there. So on a case-by-case basis, this person gave the example of a friend having severe symptoms to do with his lungs, but they mostly had severe symptoms to do with their digestive tract. So why did it present so differently? And that's still an open question, but we're getting more clues as to why these different sets of symptoms appear in different people. And there's actually been studies now that kind of categorize these different collections of symptoms into six distinct subtypes. So if you search six subtypes of COVID-19 symptoms, you can see how they kind of all converge together in kind of a set of symptoms that different people experience. So we're learning more about why that is. And again, genetics may play a key role. So as we're continuing these genetic studies, we're going to learn more about that influence later. But of course, if you already have any pre-existing conditions that impact systems that the virus messes with, you may be at higher risk of developing those types of symptoms. But that's not true across the board. As an aside, there are also kidney-related symptoms and occasionally cognitive symptoms connected to the virus. And we're learning more about those actively. Those are not considered the primary symptoms, though. Those are slightly rarer than these other symptoms I talked about. I'm getting the question about, is there any way that scientists and the media, which of course is a diverse group of organizations that bring you news, is there any way scientists and the media can better work together to determine which studies should be covered and how they should be covered in the news so they're most helpful to you, the reader, or the viewer, etc.? They give a specific example of a study, but there's been many instances where, for example, a preprint comes out. So a preprint is a study that has not yet been reviewed thoroughly by the scientific community, and it has not been published officially in a journal that requires that peer review process. Just as a follow-up, the peer review process is not without fault either. So not every study that gets published in a journal is as good as it can be. There's plenty of retractions that happen constantly. You can check out Retraction Watch. And we've had some big instances of this throughout the pandemic where studies that came out in highly respected, high-impact journals ended up being retracted shortly thereafter because their data was not valid, their data analysis was flawed, and their conclusions too overreaching. So how science journalists deal with this, I will speak as a science journalist myself, how science journalists deal with this is we reach out to both the authors of the study itself, but also people totally unaffiliated with new studies who are experts in the field as well, to lend their perspective. And number one, give us perspective as to, should we cover this at all? Is this a high enough impact? Is it a big enough deal for us to write a story about this? So that's question number one. Is it newsworthy? Number two, those experts that we call in, because we read scientific articles all day as well, are familiar with what to look out for in terms of questionable study design, really small sample sizes, all these sorts of things. These are patterns that we are familiar with as well. And here at Live Science, actually a lot of our staff have a background in science originally and then became journalists. So this is true of other science journalists at other, especially science news organizations. This is a common trend. But the outside experts really help us to hone in on blatant weaknesses in the study that we might miss as journalists. Because again, we're not experts in everything we write about, of course. We write about a diverse range of topics. So we call in the people who have spent their lives studying this thing to say, I follow what they're saying here, but here, this is definitely an overreach in terms of the conclusion, and here's why. And then we bring that to you. Either that, or if the study is too flawed, has too many holes in it, you can either approach that as a debunking story, where we're helping you to understand why you should take that study with a huge grain of salt, and we try to lead with that right at the top of the story. Or we might not cover that story at all because it's not ready for prime time. So just to give you a hint as to how we think about news coverage, that's a really key process. And again, people who specialize in covering science are very familiar with this process and do it constantly for every single story we write, whether it's life or death coronavirus type stories or a cutesy animal study. We use the same rigor for every single study we cover. That said, of course, in this context, you have journalists from all different walks of life, all trying to cover breaking news on the coronavirus. And it's very nuanced and it's very detailed. And sometimes mistakes are made. And part of that's simply the media landscape. So I don't think it can be isolated to simply looking at news coverage itself. You also have to think about where news lives now. So where do you read your news? For some people, they mostly watch cable news. So they're going to get a whole different brand of news coverage than people who pretty much only read physical newspapers versus people who only read news online. and have curated their social media so that they only see certain types of articles. So you on social media, this goes for anybody, get trapped in your own social media bubble, and the algorithm shows you things in line with what you've seen many, many times before. Sometimes that means that coverage that shouldn't get as many eyes on it becomes viral very quickly. And that's more a virtue of the ecosystem that media lives in as compared to the actual writing about the virus or the actual news content about the virus. So it's very complicated, clearly. I think about this a lot as someone who covers the coronavirus and attempts to bring people the best information that can actually help them out in daily life, but also give them a context of where we're at in the science of the pandemic. The answer to your question about how to involve scientists is why I spent so much time at the start there, is that scientists should be actively involved in news coverage for any scientific story at all, but especially coronavirus stories. And that's why you see in Live Science stories that we call up several experts to vet our stories. So they are actively involved. Of course, people are busy, so it takes the cooperation of both the journalist and the scientist to find a time to speak and to make sure that the person writing the story has full and deep understanding of what that scientist is saying. So that's our entire day. That's what we spend our days doing. So that's number one, is that they should be called upon to participate in the news coverage. There are several organizations, I know of one anyway, in the EU that take the time to review new studies that have come out and caught media attention. And if they have significant flaws, experts will weigh in and make sure that study is taken in full context. So there are organizations like that that actively call out when papers are deeply flawed and shouldn't be taken as gospel truth. The core of your question is, of course, is there any movement to improve upon how news gets to people? And there is. Actively every day, science journalists are thinking about how we could better bring news to people. And again, part of it is very much the ecosystem we live in. So it's about working with the platforms that we exist on to try to bring you the best news. So that's a big puzzle piece. And then just improving our reporting at baseline. Are we getting the best sources? Are we taking enough time to vet stories before just putting them up in front of your face? So I hope that long-winded answer got to the core of your question. If you have any more questions, both about science, but about the journalistic process surrounding the news coverage you're seeing lately, you can always pose those questions either here or on the forums at forums.livescience.com. And if I didn't get to your question today, we've covered the vast majority of these on our website, livescience.com. And you can check out our videos and our podcasts for even more content from us.
Thanks for joining us for this special coronavirus report from Life's Little Mysteries with Live Science. You can find all the Live Science coverage of the coronavirus and COVID-19 on our website at livescience.com/topics/coronavirus.
We'll be refreshing our FAQ and coronavirus updates daily as information becomes available. The link is in the show notes.
If you have questions about coronavirus or COVID-19, you can post them on our Live Science forums and on Facebook.
Thanks for joining us, and stay healthy.
Life's Little Mysteries is produced in conjunction with Audio Boom as part of their Audio Boom Originals network.